Today is Wednesday, March 18th. Good afternoon. Let the record show that the House Resources Committee was convened at 1:01 p.m. The members present are Representative Josephson, Representative Seaton, Representative Olson, Representative Mike Hucker, Chair, Vice Chair, my fellow co-chair, Representative David Tallarico, Representative Jaron Tarr, and myself, Representative Benjamin Norrell. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Thank you. Today we have CSSJR, Joint Radar Solution 13, OCS Oil and Gas Exploration Development in front of the committee. We intend to hear the presentation, hear public testimony, and bring the resolution back to the committee for discussion and action. Now we will continue with the presentation. Could the president just please come forward and identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchison. I'm the staff for Senator Coghill. Senator Coghill wanted to be here. He sends his apologies, but he's running late, so I'm going to begin the presentation. What you see before you is SJR 13. The executive summary of the resolution is that it is in opposition to the recent efforts by the federal executive branch to further restrict areas in the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea as it relates to oil and gas development. The concern specifically is the Hannah Shoal area that's in the Chukchi Sea, and there are some active and adjacent leases where they do feel like there will be a negative effect. There's concerns about the ability to renew those active leases that are currently in the area, and there's a concern that some of the mitigation costs associated with designating the Hannah Shoal as an environmentally sensitive area will further prohibit oil and gas development in that area. So I'd like to start talking about some of the maps that we have, because this clarifies the picture and gives you an idea about some of the areas that we're talking about. And some of the maps should all be in your packets that, that you have in front of you. We'll start with the Beaufort Sea. You'll see there's a lot of color, there's a lot of activity. This map was provided by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. The areas in green, the green squares, are the historic leases that the oil companies have had in the past. The area in blue is the high petroleum potential area by the coast. The red areas are the designated areas that are restricted by the federal government. So there's one, there's a subsistence area by Barrow, and there is an area by Pactovic that have been restricted previously by other administrations, and in fact it's been occurring like that since the Bush administration. It's every 5 years the restriction goes forward. The Obama administration has done the same activity as it relates to the 2012 to 2017 planning session. So those areas, you can see there's not any active leases that are in those. The active leases are the yellow squares that you see. Those are the most important for our purposes. I'll do a close-up here. In Barrow and Kaktovik, you see it's all green leases, so those are all historic leases. The oil companies generally don't have an ongoing interest in those. The yellow active leases are the ones that we're most concerned about. So there's a less cluttered view of what it looks like and what the proposed area is that the Obama administration is moving forward with. There's one more close-up of the area. So the real concern that many see is in the Chukchi. Now, you see there's a lot more activity. The blue area, again, is the high petroleum potential areas. There's evidence, of course, of more active leases. You see a lot more yellow squares. I'll explain a few things on the bottom. That red line you see near the coast, that's the 25-mile buffer zone. The only thing that exists in that 25-mile area is those those green leases, those historic leases, those are no longer of any interest to the producers. You also see up in the pink and red area on the right-hand side, that's the subsistence area for Barrow. You see there's no active leases, and so there's not really resistance to that portion of it. The key area is in the middle with the Hannah Shoal portion. That's that yellow circle that's been studied the previous 5 years. You see that there's yellow leases, there's active leases in there, and there's historic leases, and there is a large portion of petroleum, a high petroleum potential area in that designated area. So why is that important? There's a close-up of what it looks like in the area that's been studied. Here's the actual designated area as it relates to the 2017 to 2022 draft proposed program area. What is the effect? Why is that important to us? Because Shell has three leases, active leases, that are adjacent to the Hannah Shoal area. Repsol has seven leases actually in the area itself. And there's another five that are in the adjacent area that Repsol has that deal with similar petroleum prospects. And the concern is that when you designate an area as an environmental concern, that you're going to have a decreased ability to renew those leases beyond 2022, and you're concerned that you're going to increase the amount of mitigation costs that the oil producer are going to have to have because you're in an environmentally sensitive area. So those are the major. That's the major concern that most have with the proposed designation that just occurred. So this is just it further shows some of the areas as it relates to just further clarification as to what some of the proposed area looks like. And this is taken from the White House and BOEM as to the withdrawn areas. You see the 25-mile buffer area, you see the subsistence area around Barrow, and you see the Hannah Shoal area, which is the new component to all this. So with that, if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Anybody have questions? If not, I have a statement. Here we go again. It really upsets me that people who live there, most of them have been working on this issue for years and years and years, all along the coast, working with the whalers, working with the industry, working with everybody, and going through the issue of reliance on our resources offshore and onshore. And here we go again. We have all this potential. But when it comes to us as native people and or people who live along the coast where we rely on renewable resources, we also rely on non-renewable resources for our tax base and for our livelihoods. A lot of people work in that area, and without the oil industry, we wouldn't be where we are today. And just a few weeks ago, the federal government placed, or the president again, is considering placing the Channel 2 area near where I was born as a wilderness. And so the United States of America, when oil was discovered, suddenly found out they had to do a land claims. So they heard for the past couple of years or whatever it took, and did a land claims. And they also created corporations. And what are corporations? Well, they're an instrument to make money. And why did the government give us corporations when you wanted tribes? Well, they gave us corporations and they locked up the areas where our resources are, where our resources have been since time immemorial. Our people use those resources. They use peat for the well soap for generations upon generations before Alaska was discovered. So here we go again. What are we to do when the government of the United States, in infinite wisdom, gave us an instrument to say, "Go up, go and enrich yourself, enrich yourself." But in the meantime, we'll lock up every piece of land, every piece of water you're going to have, and you're not going to have anything. That's exactly what it is right now. We didn't ask for corporations. But then for the past several years, this has been happening. After working diligently for years and years and years, working with the industry, with the government, with everybody. And so, what are we to do? There's one federal agency who's locking up everything on for those of us who depend on our resource, and another agency who's willing to work with us and finding ways to make sure that everything is protected in that area where they're going to open up, where they have opened up areas for oil and gas exploration. So we have two agencies that have given us heartache and hope at the same time. So what are we to do? What are my families going to do in Kakhtovik when they have a resource right underneath their feet but they can't use it? So that is my vent for the day. And anybody else, I give you an opportunity to knock me out or whatever, or agree with me. And so with that, we'll move forward.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Joseph.
I have a question.
I'm Representative Josephson.
Thank you. I have a question for the presenter. My understanding is part of this announcement that the resolution refers to, at the same time, the president for the first time authorize some exploratory development in a very preliminary stage from Virginia down to the South Carolina coast. And I'm wondering, since, as far as I know, he's the first to allow that, do you think that these restrictions in the Arctic are because of Shell's performance in 2012?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, my personal opinion is that it might be, from their perspective, related to that. It might be, from their perspective, related to an overreaching philosophical decision as it relates to climate change and environmentally sensitive areas. I think that's what I've heard when I've heard the administration discuss the topic.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? I asked that already. I'd like to open public testimony. Please state your name, your affiliation, and limit your testimony to 3 minutes. Is there anyone in the room to testify? Mr. Kerr? State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. As you know, AOGA is the professional trade association for the oil and gas industry in Alaska, and my members represent the majority of the producers, explorers, refiners, marketing, and transportation activities here in the state. As you know, our members have been operating in the Arctic for more than 40 years. Oil and gas development is the backbone of Alaska's economy. and as the largest undeveloped energy basin in the United States, the Arctic Outer Continental Shelf, or the OCS, is truly the next generation of energy security for our country. The Arctic OCS holds enormous oil and gas resources, estimated by the Department of Interior at approximately 27 billion barrels of oil and 132 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. In comparison, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, or TAPS, has carried more than 17 billion barrels of oil in just over 30 years. So TAPS has played a critical link in the nation's energy security, transporting crude oil from Alaska's North Slope to West Coast markets. The OCS development and the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas could feed into TAPS and maintain its viability for many more years to come. Additionally, oil and gas development in the Arctic OCS means more jobs for Alaskans. Development of the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas is predicted to produce an annual average of 35,000 direct and indirect jobs, representing a total payroll of over $70 billion. Since 1971, 84 wells have been drilled in the Arctic OCS, all without incident. Industry has worked with communities to incorporate traditional knowledge in decision-making, establish conflict avoidance agreements, and impose seasonal drilling limitations. New regulations and further research has further ensured that development and environmental protection can coexist. Three of our member companies hold leases within the withdrawn areas or directly adjacent to it in the map shown to you by Mr. Hutchinson. While the federal withdrawal language states that, quote, nothing in this withdrawal affects the rights under existing leases in the withdrawn areas, unquote, there are still many unknowns for the operators, such as the ability to renew active leases, or how the transport or building of infrastructure into a pipeline would be affected. The prior four lease sales scheduled in the Beaufort and Chukchi were included in the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's previous five-year leasing plan, but was withdrawn and subsequently not held. It is our fear that additional restrictions or delays will limit the opportunities for development in the Arctic OCS. As the sea ice stays open longer and other countries move forward with exploration and development in their waters and transportation through the ice-free Northwest Passage, Alaska's Arctic seas could be left largely unattended. With little infrastructure in place, communities along Alaska's north coast will be at the greatest risk with no ability to respond. Development of the Arctic OCS for exploration and development would bring that infrastructure to a very rural onshore area, and the industry's continued presence would provide security and response capabilities should they be needed. So it goes without saying, AOGA does support this joint resolution to maintain all of the proposed leasing areas in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas and to resist additional restrictions on leasing in the final program. We would also like to thank Senator Coghill and his office for their work on this and for bringing it forward today. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Anybody have questions? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience? There's none. Is there anyone at the Legislative Information Offices that would like to testify? There's none. Is there anyone off net? Questionable. All right. Thank you for your testimony today. I'd like to close public testimony now. Any questions or comments from the committee members? If not, I'll entertain a motion for my co-chair. Representative Tarr.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just kind of moving quickly here, I guess. I mean, I do have concerns about this resolution, and the staff person was good to mention that, you know, four of the five areas withdrawn were previously excluded, so there has been a history under both Democratic and Republican administrations to exclude those areas from leasing. And in what I've been able to read about the new area, it was, you know, picked for biological importance and the subsistence needs of people that live nearby, and just to make sure that the marine animals and the endangered whales that swim through those areas are protected and will be there for future generations. So I guess I'm cautious about approaching this, and I guess even more so because we haven't resolved the revenue issue, so the state doesn't stand to gain much from this OCS development. And for me, I guess I'd like to see that matter resolved before we move forward, because we want to balance the state's needs with sort of, I guess, you know, what would be perhaps perceived as more of a national interest kind of opportunity if we're not going to really benefit much from the revenue. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Well, you know, as I stated earlier, we've been working on this issue for a very long time. We've been doing studies. The North Shore Borough has a Department of Wildlife Management, and I was a director for many years of that department. And I've been involved in offshore and onshore issues for more than half my life. And I've watched all this stuff happening. In fact, I was my first job was right after high school was a junk hustler in Poudre Bay, 1969. So I've been involved in oil issues for a very long time, and being involved in working with the industry and others. For the record, Bob Heron, Representative Bob Heron is here. So it just upsets me when things like this happen, even though some were discussed as important and everything. But you know, back in the late 80s or early 90s, there were when they were looking to see how the how those offshore rigs would work, they had one right outside of Barrow, up by the point, you remember. And they put that there before the winter, and they started that. And that area right there were put on for where they put it. That's around the area where the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea meet. Mm-hmm. And to us, that's a very volatile area. I've been there many times in the summertime hunting, and when you're out hunting and you find a kind of like vegetation on top and bubbles and everywhere, we follow that because that's where the animals follow, and then we follow it all the way over. And I remember right in front of Barrow. Point, right in front of the point where where we were looking, and we saw all kinds of animals, and then we were after them, and then the ice, we saw the ice coming. I mean, it was incredible. It was coming in so fast, and we almost got locked in. So we know how that area is. We know how dangerous it is. We told everybody and their brother when they come up to do work in that area. We use that information. Now, it's not only me, but it's people who use that resource. They have that information and they pass it on. And that's how we deliberate in our area. So we will, you know, we will continue to talk about this. We will, in our area, we will continue to talk about this in this committee, and we'll continue to talk about what the administration and others have been trying to do. Is there objection still maintained?
I haven't offered one, and I'm not going to be objecting.
Pardon?
I haven't offered an objection. I'm not going to be objecting.
There's no objection?
No,
kind of
a
motion
first.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. And I, one of the things I want to say, I plan on making a motion, but I do appreciate your input from this. I don't think it's rare sometimes that we get actual firsthand knowledge and experience from someone who's been got thoroughly knows the area like the back of their hand, for a lack of better terms. So I appreciate that, and I would like to put a motion forward.
Go ahead.
I'd like to make a motion to move a committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 13, number 29-LS0471/N, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
There's a motion on the floor. Any objections? Any discussion? With that, CSS Joint Resolution 13 from the Resources Motion Committee. We'll take a brief adage for the signing of the committee report. Thank you.
From a lease sale? I know, that's what I was trying to figure out.
If members of the public would like to submit their written testimony to the committee, please email to lhres@akleg.gov or fax to 907-465-2827. I repeat, fax to 907-465-2827. Now we will continue with the Trista Corporation presentation. Could the presenters please come forward and identify yourself for the record? Welcome.
Wait, no, that's it.
Please state your names and affiliations for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Monica James with Trista Corporation.
George Olipek, Trista Corporation.
Go ahead.
Representative Nagiak, Representative Tarelko, esteemed members of the House Resources Committee, thank you for the opportunity to take this time and share with you our region and our people. Today, there will be myself, Monica James, as we shared, and George Olipek with the Trista Corporation. I am Yupik Eskimo, originally from Aleknik, and I grew up in Bethel. George is also Yupik Eskimo from the village of Marshall. George and I are both original Trista shareholders. The Trista region is remote with no roads, and the only accessibility is by plane or boat. Trista has the highest population of remote Alaskans.
For the record, Representative Johnson is here.
Thank you.
We'll take a brief at ease, please. Back on record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Trista has the largest population of remote, that's remote where Alaskans are living in our region. We are the most economically challenged region in Alaska, with 27% of our residents living below the federal poverty level. Many of our residents pay upwards of 58% of their annual income on energy-related costs. Despite these statistics, we are a resilient, culturally rich people that have thrived in a challenging environment with little infrastructure, incorporating our traditional subsistence lifestyle. Our presentation will demonstrate, even in the face of these contemporary realities of lack of infrastructure and crippling energy costs, achievements have been made as a region with what we have. That said, there are opportunities to continue increasing these triumphs through development of public facility infrastructure, which will empower the ability to sustain our villages. There have been natural resources developed in the fishing industry with little to no infrastructure to support it. You will hear testimony regarding updates and developments to the Dahlman Creek Project, efforts of the Chinook Wind Group, who have a vision of addressing high energy costs. We have natural resources for potential development, and with partnering with the state of Alaska and the federal government, sound investments to address the energy crisis in our region, we will not only support the sustainability of people, but we will foster economic development for all Alaskans that live in the Chulista region that want employment opportunities to create industry to change socioeconomic disadvantages.
In regards to community sustainability, we rely on transportation and energy to achieve economic growth. For example, history shows America's towns had many booms and busts. Towns can come and go if unsustainable. 2,700 towns disappeared in the last 100 years, mostly in southwest United States. Alaska has this history too. From 1800s to mid-1900s, Alaska packers ruled the salmon industry, providing 80% of territory tax revenue. 37 cannery towns are now gone. The baby state of Alaska had 22 towns and villages disappear since the 1900s. So which towns in Alaska survived the best? For example, Ketchikan in southeast Alaska survived many difficult times repeatedly. Its economy used available resources and adapted. From salmon processing in the 1880s, mining in the 1900s, to the 1950s, salmon and halibut cold storage in the 30s, the forestry industry in the 50s to the late 90s, tourism in the 80s, seafood and most recently mining. The stabilizing factors have been transportation and affordable energy through early hydropower in 1903, which made Ketchikan affordable and competitive. Today, Ketchikan has one of the highest resident state per capita income from transportation accessibility, stable affordable energy, natural resource extraction for jobs and economy. And these are what we rely on in southwest Alaska. Our projects are related to transportation. We have a $1.4 million request for roads, design, engineering, and permits for the Pilcher Mountain project. You see on the top right hand is Marshall of Pilcher Mountain in the background, and a $7.5 million request for the Emonic Dock project that would contribute to an expanded economic opportunity. Both, and this is key, both are part of a 50% federal and state match funding request as seed capital.
As budgets tighten at the federal and state levels, communities with little infrastructure struggle. The Chulista region lacks infrastructure and yet is still being developed. The Chulista region, in relative size to the state of Oregon, has 57,000 square miles of area with little infrastructure and the highest cost of living. We have 25,735 residents living in this remote area. We have 56 regional communities with populations ranging from 200 to 6,100 with a growing young population. We have no interconnecting roads, no transmission grids, which prevents cost sharing of our assets. If you look at the map, you can see all of the communities in the Chulista region. In nearly all of the communities, there is a K through 12 school. But yet there's only one true high school in this region. That's the Bethel High School. This tends to lead to low graduation rates, low scores, many dropouts. Often there's poor quality of education and high teacher turnover. And also in part, teachers don't have the ability to build home equity when they're teaching in the villages. The state graduation rate is 65%. The Lower Yukon School District has a 43.81% graduation rate, while the Lower Kuskokwim School District has a 42.75% graduation rate. We have a high teacher turnover rate at 30%. Many of the villages, the 56 villages that we're talking about, have independent aging diesel generation system for village power. Most villages have a runway. For example, Marshall has a 100-foot wide, 3,200 feet long runway that can support small aircraft. We do have a couple of hub airports, runways and airstrips in Aniak and St. Mary's. In the 56 villages, most of them have health clinics. And there is limited access to state troopers and VPSO when we have a high need of public safety.
In regards to the cost of high energy, we look at the slide and showing heating fuel in the YK Delta at $6.38 average compared to the on-road system at $3.41. Gasoline is at $6.90 compared to average for the on-road heating, gasoline at $3.42. What's also important is the State of Alaska Fish and Game Department provides statistics on subsistence harvests for the Bethel Hub villages. We have 85% of households harvesting subsistence resources, and 70% of those households are sharing their catch, with a total estimated harvest in pounds of 954,000 pounds of subsistence resources. Nearly 1 million pounds a year are being harvested in foods to feed families, and 70% of those households are giving it away to their family and friends.
There is a need on the Lower Kuskum region for a port. There is no regional port in the 700 miles between Bethel and Nome. We do have an interportal linkage that connects economically with the Nenana and Fairbanks Rail and Highway with the port in Anchorage. We have an example of shipping that occurs, and this is with the village of Marshall, where they shipped housing material from Seattle via Fairbanks using Nenana barges.
The native village of Marshall, which is a tribe, used BIA housing improvement program money. We built 25 homes and gave them away to our elders. The most cost-efficient means to transport material from Tacoma, Washington, is to go from Washington to Anchorage, use competitive trucking to go up the highway to Fairbanks, and we hired local Nenana barges to ship the material down the Yukon River. So we have an intermodal linkage from Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Lower Yukon River that we can capitalize on in future projects.
The Chulista region is divided. Geographically, we have the Yukon River, we have the Kuskokwim River, and we have our coastal areas. Politically, we're represented by Dillingham, Nome, and Bethel House districts. Administratively, the state DOT and PF divides our region into the northern and central regions. The court system, the Fourth Judicial Court in Fairbanks, oversees our region.
What's important to note about the Imanac Lower Yukon Port is that it will provide infrastructure for potential offshore oil and gas development from Middle Earth and shipping?
Yes. So a point here with our map, if you look at EMO, knowing that the Arctic shipping is going to be developed in the future, that the Imanac Dock can serve as an emergency response plan because we need to be prepared to address potential hazards with the future shipping through the Arctic.
Additionally, in regards to using the port for potential offshore oil and gas development in the Imanac area, we have identified modular LNG plants. There's a company in, I believe it was Argentina, that is U.S. Coast Guard approved, that can provide these modular LNG plants, which are a fraction of the cost of an LNG plant. So potentially, if there is oil and gas development off the Lower Yukon, the Imanac port will have an infrastructure that we can capitalize on to export gas to the region and even up the river to the Nenana Fairbanks if necessary.
Here on this slide, you can see on the lower bottom the green highlight. There's Imanac, and this is the dock that we're advocating here, and Imanac can service all of these communities to help make freight shipping more economical. Currently, the port in Imanac would facilitate the safe and efficient offloading of cargo from barges. Currently, there's challenges. There's overcrowding, erosion, and flooding. If we do nothing, the erosion will be persistent on the riverbank erosion and flooding, which would pose a significant threat to the existing physical infrastructure of local maritime industry businesses. Supporting economic diversity and stability in the Monarch Dock results in maritime industry growth and expansion, which develops a more diverse economic base.
The Monarch project is total $17.2 million in total cost. It is permitted and shovel-ready. The City of Monarch received $500,000 in 2009 from a state grant for port design in FY13. Backtrack. In 2011, the Army Corps of Engineers approved the port design. In 2012, the City of Monarch received a $3 million FY13 general obligation bond, which is delivering rock by October 2015 from Nome, St. Mary's, and Stebbins. The request for phase one for the Monarch project is $7.5 million of the remaining $14 million balance, which goes back to the 50-50 state match. We are going back to Washington, D.C. next week and propose the same message that we have federal assistance to match state assistance, which will also be part of our private investment in the region.
Here's an example of community sustainability, the Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association. Despite the lack of port facility in Monarch, the Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association maritime industry businesses have demonstrated sufficient growth. These businesses establish Monarch as an economic center for the region, providing employment, income, and services to residents throughout the lower Yukon.
The Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association has several subsidiaries, and they are part of the CDK group. Quickpack Fisheries from 2002 to 2013 bought 21 million pounds of salmon, infusing $21 million in cash directly to 451 fishermen. Quickpack Fisheries paid in 2014 over $15 million in aggregate wages to region workers. Quickpack Youth Employment Program provides summer employment to 14 to 17-year-olds, and they paid over $1 million to youth in the last 4 years. Yukon Marine Manufacturing, since 1999, have manufactured, built, and sold 243 20 to 24-foot skiffs. They employ local welders to build and repair boats for area residents. Yukon River Towing, and I'd like to point the middle picture in the slide on the bottom. They built a bunkhouse in the Monarch, which sleeps 30 people. They use siding from logs delivered by local residents and milled at a local sawmill. They're manufacturing lumber out of logs that come down the Yukon. There's thousands and thousands of logs that come down the Yukon. They're using local residents and a local sawmill to build bunkhouses, homes. They have developed a log and stick frame home kit for lower Yukon residents. And they are using a program offered by United States Housing and Urban Development, which offers low-interest mortgage loans for home buyers.
The Marshall Rock Dock and Quarry Road would complement community sustainability. Currently, the Lower Yukon region must purchase material from Nome at exorbitant cost. Constructing a quarry in Marshall would result in reducing public costs by $20 to $24 million for DOT and PF identified region airport upgrade projects. Additional savings are anticipated for future regional infrastructure with local high-grade gravel and armor rock at a significantly lower cost. This quarry at Pilcher Mountain has a 25-year life of producing material. The Native Village of Marshall identifies Indian Reservation Road funds as a 10% federal match. The location of the quarry also reduces hazards of offloading freight and heavy vehicle materials on unimproved eroding shoreline landing, For public safety, this plan separates heavy equipment from the local foot traffic.
Northern Region DOT and PF office identified several projects they want to use Pilcher Mountain Rock. They wrote a letter to us. The projects are St. Mary's Mountain Village Road Rehabilitation, rehabilitating 15-mile road, St. Mary's and Mountain Village, estimated cost $13 million. Pilot Station Airport Relocation Project will construct a new airport in a 3-mile road, estimated cost $10 to $20 million. St. Mary's Improvement Runway Improvement Project, estimated at $10 to $20 million. Nunamequa or Sheldon's Point Runway Extension is estimated at $2.5 to $5 million. These are the projects that DOT wrote in a letter to us stating DOT is looking for material. The rock for the Lower Yukon projects must be barged from Maine at a high cost. Pilcher Mountain is of great interest to us. The picture on the left on the slide, you will see a topographic map, and there's a on the top left-hand corner, a proposed road from the proposed dock site. It's 3 miles running along the ridge line up to the mountain site. If you look at the picture on Pilcher Mountain, you'll see a white patch on the top right-hand corner. That's an existing quarry. And we can't see it clearly now, but there's also a road that's depicted in the topographical map from Marshall to the top of the Pilcher Mountain where there is a cell tower.
The dock.
Another important point to make about the location of this dock, it is inside a natural river eddy. So over time, annually, as you have breakup, this would protect the dock because of the location. There is a consensus on village cluster consolidated services to develop a more robust energy transportation infrastructure for Western Alaska that consolidates public services and infrastructure support for community sustainability. The Chulista region is a good model. We have many villages, many small villages that lack basic infrastructure, so doing a cluster approach would work in our region.
What we are planning on and what we are working on and proposing is, I'd like to share an anecdote before we point this out. Many of us from the region are graduates of boarding school. Myself, I was a graduate of a Jesuit boarding school at St. Mary's Mission from 1979 to 1983. My older sister is a graduate of 4 years of boarding school. And my dad turned 80 last summer. He said, we lost something when we lost boarding schools. When they put a high school in every village, we lost the quality of education that boarding schools used to provide. That's from the elders. My nephew is in high school. My nieces are in high school. They go to Galena for boarding school. They themselves, the young people, are voting with their feet and they're going to boarding school because they recognize the quality of education that a boarding school potentially can provide. Part of our solution to the high cost of living in Chulista is to do that. We have clusters of communities that are grouped closely together. We are proposing that we are building infrastructure that would serve these cluster communities. For example, in St. Mary's and Mountain Village, there's a road 15 miles connecting the village since the early 80s. We have, I believe, 6,000-foot runway at St. Mary's, which used to land Mark Air jets in the early 80s. We can do that for the cluster communities. We can provide regional high schools that would serve the cluster communities rather than building 30, $40 million high schools in every little village. Why not build a regional, sub-regional high school for the cluster communities, build roads to connect those villages, connect, and it is pointed out that the Anchorage School District buses students from Gridwood. And how many miles is that, 30? We can bus kids from 15 miles away and bring them to the high schools. And then we can focus on a higher quality of education with specialists in the high schools. We can focus on elementary schools only, middle schools only. And that's a solution to address the statistics that show 6 out of 10 of our high school students do not graduate. There's a potential solution there. And we already talked about airports. But also, this is part of our proposal to address the high cost of energy. We can have sub-regional gas-powered power plants that serve with high voltage, high wattage interties with the surrounding communities. And we're going to talk about a gas pipeline shortly to tie into this cluster community concept.
I'd like to highlight an example of a successful program, and this particular one was the Chininic Wind Group. They established 4 wind turbines in one of these clusters, and that would be in this area here. There's the village of Chininic right here, and the village of Kungiganak, Kwagigalak, and Kipnak. So these 4 villages have turbines in their communities that are connected. And based on the wind turbines that have been installed, there has been a 30% displacement of fuel costs of their power plants and a 30% displacement of fuel costs in the homes that are participating in this project.
There are state and local benefits. We talked about the state benefits to reduce duplication. We would achieve economies of scale and the lower costs associated with economies of scale. We would be able to coordinate state agency master plans. We would share resources. We would have centralized better schools. And we would leverage limited state capital and operating funds. Local benefits would include linked communities, more reliable power, cheaper energy and transportation costs, higher quality services, improved education for rural students, improved emergency services and resources.
The map that it's kind of hard to read and probably see, but there is a little trail from the Paimute here to Tuxuk Bay that's been well traveled, and then there's a little out here to Tununuk, there's another trail. So those are just, if you imagine winter trails, snow machine trails, they've used these. So potentially this could become a road system in this cluster thought process. The Donlin Creek Mine affords access to energy. There is a $1 billion pipeline privately financed to propose a 15-mile gas pipeline project that would transport natural gas from the Beluga natural gas pipeline system 30 miles west of Anchorage to the Donlin Creek mine. Completing the gas pipeline project provides a future opportunity for federal, state, public, private partnership to expand the natural gas powered electric intertie network into the region. This has potential to expand the natural gas pipeline into the region, thus reducing reliance on subsidized electricity from the power cost equalization. We are optimistic to have the Donlin Creek project move forward. The infrastructure development results from this project could potentially aid in reducing the energy crisis we currently face. The Marshall Dock and Quarry would provide reduce public costs for the rock material to the lower Yukon projects. We request your support and strong consideration for the $1.34 million funding request for the road design, engineering, and permits. The Yamanak Dock has possibilities of future expansion for business development activities, which potentially could include support of offshore oil and gas and Arctic development. If the $7.5 million request can be funded collaboratively with the state of Alaska and the federal government. Guyana.
Thank you very much. Any questions from committee members? Representative Parr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. just a couple of questions. One on the request, the 2 requests. So the $1.4 million would actually, it looks like, complete that project. But on the other project with the $516,000 that's in hand, the $3 million from the GEO bonds and the $7.5 million, it looks like roughly $6.2 million would be left for funding on that project. Is that the piece of funding you'd be looking to the federal government for? Or where would the additional funding come from? Just
thinking of being cautious about, you know, funding projects we can't finish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Parr, that is correct. The original project was about 14.2, and that was from several years ago. And the engineers have come back to the city of Amonic, which has come to us and added some inflation for the cost of material and the cost of services and the cost of energy. So these are the latest numbers we have. There's about 13.8 or so million balance left over, but phase one in its, there's a phase one in its entirety that will cost 7.5, which does leave 6.9 or so as the remaining balance.
Okay. Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, but a comment to both Monica and George. I've watched them grow up all these years and become leaders in the Chilista organization. But what they've demonstrated to my colleagues, of course, the chairman already has the same issues in his region, is that essentially I have 32 separate communities that have to stand alone as compared to some of my colleagues like in Anchorage that multiple members that have a one common community. But I appreciate the Chilista Corporation showing this to the committee of the challenges I face as a representative in Western Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Representative Tarr.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking, and I just wanted to understand a little bit better some of the income sources. The median income here listed around $46,000, and on the slide, you know, the 451 fishermen, if you just roughly split that up evenly, the take would be about $46,000 per fisherman. Just was trying to understand sort of where that median income comes from for folks in the region and if that's an accurate representation of the success that the people are having that are professionally, you know, having fishing as their livelihood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Parr, Amonic is unique in the respect that it is a CDQ community. They have a fleet of offshore trawlers that is able to underwrite the cost of purchasing commercial salmon from the commercial fishermen in the lower Yukon. Therefore, the wages paid to the region's residents and the amount paid for ex vessel value of the salmon that they harvest commercially is an anomaly. The rest of the region is mired in poverty because of a lack of resource development, because of a lack of access to cheap transportation, because of a lack of access or ability to produce cheap energy. So the percentages are U.S. Census data as an aggregate average of over 25,000 people. But the numbers for Amonic and that region are skewed. They're skewing the average higher than it would otherwise normally be because of their access for resource development off the trawl industry.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Thank you very much. We'll take a brief at ease to set up for the next presenters. Now we will continue with a Dawn and Gold presentation. Could the presenter please come forward and identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is James Fugue. I'm the study manager for Dawn and Gold.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the Donlin project and just a status update on the permitting that we are currently going through. Okay. Moving on to the first slide, Donlin Gold is the operating company for the Donlin Gold project. We're jointly owned by two companies, Barrick Gold, which is the world's largest gold mining corporation, and Nova Gold. We operate in partnership with our partners, Alaska Native Corporations, Chilista, with whom we have a mining lease agreement. The deposit itself is located on lands owned by Calista and TKC that were selected several decades ago for their mineral potential. And then we have a separate surface use agreement with the Kuskokwim Corporation, TKC, which allows for the use of the lands. And together with our partners, we are committed to advancing the Donlin project in close cooperation and coordination with the stakeholders in the region in an environmentally responsible and safe manner to bring benefits to all of us as we partner on moving this project forward. As you've seen in the previous presentation, the deposit itself is located about 270 miles west of Anchorage, or some 10 miles north of the community of Crooked Creek on the Kuskokwim River. Crooked Creek is the closest community to the project. And again, as you heard in the previous presentation, there is a dire need for infrastructure in this area. If you look at that map, you see that there's a complete lack of any infrastructure between Anchorage and the rail belt and the project site. As that, should the project move ahead, Donlin will propose to build and operate all the infrastructure needed to support the project through construction and operations. Moving on to the site layout slide. This slide shows a 3D rendering of what the project might look like after about 25 years of operation. This would be a large open pit mine, and you see the typical features you expect to see with an operation like that. The open pit, the waste rock storage facility, the tailings storage facility, and the mill located on the ridge between the waste rock storage and the tailings storage facilities. Donlin Gold is a large deposit by any measure. There's some 33 million ounces in the reserve. That places it in the top portion or fraction of undeveloped gold projects around the world. That reserve would support a mine life of more than 27 years with an annual production of more than 1 million ounces. If it were developed, Donlin would be one of the few mines around the world that actually produces more than 1 million ounces annually. It would be a large open pit operation, moving more than 400,000 tons of rock per day, and the mill itself would process some 60,000 tons of rock per day. Power would be generated on site using a gas-fired power plant with a pipeline from Cook Inlet to supply the gas to power that plant. Moving on to the next slide. Donlin is proposing to build a state-of-the-art engineered tailings facility. This would be a rockfall constructed dam similar to that at the Fort Knox mine, which has operated safely for many years outside of Fairbanks, Alaska. The rockfall dam abutment would be constructed using what's known as the downstream construction method, which is the most robust and engineeringly sound method of construction, similar to that used for water retention dams around the world. We would excavate the overburden down to the bedrock before placing the rockfall in the dam wall. This would also be the first tailings facility built in Alaska with a complete synthetic liner to cover the full basin of the tailings storage facility and thereby protecting the groundwater and other resources underneath the tailings storage facility. This would be a low-density polyethylene liner similar to that used in industrial waste facilities throughout the country. Over the years, as we've developed and engineered the project, we've conducted numerous subsurface investigations in the tailings dam footprint to better understand the geotechnical conditions we're dealing with. This includes some 41 core drill holes, many of which were drilled with chilled fluids, so that when we bring the cores back up to surface, the ice and clay layers within those cores remain intact, so we better understand the geotechnical conditions we're dealing with. We've also drilled some 37 auger holes, dug about 60 test pits, conducted 18 seismic surveys, and run 4 resistivity lines. As the design advances through detailed design towards construction, we'll conduct additional on-site investigations and drilling to fully identify the subsurface conditions that have the potential to impact the design and construction. Moving on to the next slide, we've heard a lot about infrastructure. Since there is no existing infrastructure in the area, we would propose to build all the infrastructure needed to construct and operate the project. This would include a 30-mile road from a port site to be constructed on the Kuskokwim River near the mouth of Young Yup Creek, a 5,000-foot runway a 600-man permanent camp to support the project during operations and a 2,500-man temporary camp to support the project during construction. We would also propose to build a, together with our partners, to build a port site specific for the project at the community of Bethel on the downriver side of the Kuskokwim. In addition to that, there's a 315-mile gas pipeline that we're proposing to build from Cook Inlet. Moving on to the logistics and supply chain slide. During operations, the project would require some 100,000 tons a year annually of consumables, including mining consumables, truck tires, and so forth, as well as 30 to 40 million gallons of fuel annually to power the mobile fleet associated with the mine. We anticipate supplying these consumables and fuel directly from the West Coast. Consumables would come via line haul barge out of the West Coast, most likely Seattle to Tacoma, into Bethel. Fuel would either be transported via tanker to Dutch Harbor and then via line haul barge into Bethel, or possibly directly from the West Coast into Bethel on line haul barges. In Bethel, the fuel and consumables would be transferred to shallow draft river barges for the 185-mile trip up the river to the port site at Young Yuk, and then onto trucks for transport to the mine site. We would have a tank farm and storage areas large enough to hold all the supplies needed to operate through the winter season when the river is frozen. Moving on to the natural gas pipeline slide. As you've heard, we are proposing to build a 315-mile buried 14-inch steel pipeline to carry gas from Cook Inlet, the west side of Cook Inlet near Beluga, to the Donlin project site. This pipeline would use a single compressor station located near Beluga, and in its current configuration would be able to move about 70 million cubic feet of gas per day. At this point, we anticipate needing between 30 and 35 million cubic feet of gas per day to power the mine site. The average running load at the mine site would be around 150 megawatts. To put it in perspective, that's similar to what the community of Fairbanks uses. The pipeline would be constructed using temporary infrastructure, which would be reclaimed after development. This would be what's known as an open access pipeline, most likely a contract carrier. And this is a requirement of the right-of-way leases from both the state and the federal government, whose lands we would have to cross to build the pipeline. Although this is a lot smaller than some of the pipeline projects currently being considered in the state, this is by itself a challenging and expensive project. Moving on to the next slide, the permitting process for Donlin started in July of 2012, when the initial federal permit applications were filed with the Corps of Engineers. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is the lead agency for the EIS for the Donlin project. The project currently being permitted includes the 315-mile gas pipeline, the mine site facilities and operations, and the infrastructure previously discussed. The schedule you see here is a schedule put out by the Corps and represents the current view of when the EIS would be completed. Right now, it looks like we're looking at a record of decision sometime in 2017, with a draft environmental impact statement going out for public comment later this year. We'd also like to thank the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and other state agencies for their role in the permitting process and their efforts to keep the permitting on track and comprehensive. They've done a great job for us, and we appreciate their efforts. Moving on to the next slide, public scoping meetings. Donlin has a long history in the region. We've been out there for 20 years, and through that time, we've been known for our high level of stakeholder engagement and consultation, and we've been very supportive of that process continuing through the EIS. What this slide shows is the process that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers used in doing the scoping for the Donlin EIS. They conducted 13 scoping meetings looking for local input and testimony at various locations around the project site, one in Anchorage and then 12 communities located in Western Alaska. Donlin facilitated transportation from all the surrounding spoke communities into these central hubs where the meetings were conducted, thereby allowing residents of every community to participate in the scoping process and give testimony as they desired. We believe this is one of the most comprehensive scoping processes ever conducted for an EIS. Next slide, community engagement. As I mentioned, we have a long history of partnership and engagement with the communities out there, and we consider ourselves part of the family of southwestern Alaska, and we continue to remain engaged with the communities as the project moves through permitting. We maintain staffed year-round offices in Bethel and Aniak, and we conduct some 30 village meetings per year. We have fluent Yupik speakers on staff, and when we go into a village, we offer presentations in either English or Yupik at the selection of the village. We also have materials including videos and project brochures and other materials in Yupik. And our staff has worked to develop a Yupik glossary of mining terms to help people understand the technology that we are proposing to use at the site. We've had a long reputation for a local hire on the project. As we move through permitting, there are limited field activities going on. And so our focus on workforce development has evolved to school outreach, and we now spend a lot of time involved in outreach to middle and high school students, trying to prepare them or help them prepare for the jobs that would become available if the project moves ahead. We also have an active scholarship program that supports students in the region both for technical and university level education. We have a community investment program that focuses on cultural preservation, environmental protection, community wellness, and education. And we look forward to continuing our partnership with the communities of the region as the project moves forward. In closure, I would just like to say a few words about the potential economic benefits to this region that really needs them should the project move ahead. During construction, we're working at looking at a peak workforce of around 3,000 people. This will result in a direct payroll of some $375 million a year over the 3 to 4 year construction period. During operations, we're looking at an average workforce of around 900 people. It varies over the life of the mine, with a direct annual payroll in the region of $100 million a year, and an indirect and induced payroll of $60 million a year. This is over a 27-plus year period. As we heard from the previous statistics, we believe this could have many positive impacts for the region. In addition to wages and salaries, there will be significant royalties going to our partners at Calista and TKC. Many of these will be further distributed throughout the entire state under the 7I and 7J provisions of ANCSA. If you look to Red Dog, that's a really good example of how this works, and many of the revenues from Red Dog have been shared around the entire state. In addition to those revenues, the project would pay both mining license taxes and income and corporate income taxes to the state general fund, thereby directly contributing to the cost of state government. With that, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from committee members? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back on slide 5, talking about the tailings retaining dam, there was a dam failure a year and a half ago in Canada. Would you explain the difference in that dam that failed and this one in the construction and the philosophy behind that construction?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I'll start by clarifying that I'm not a geotechnical engineer, so I'm probably not the best person to do this, but there were substantial differences. As I mentioned, this would be a rockfall, 100% rockfall dam. My understanding is the one that failed was not. It was not constructed using the downstream construction method that they utilized a process whereby the tailings actually become part of the dam wall. That's not what we're proposing to do. And most importantly, we have spent nearly a couple of decades collecting climate data in the area, and we also have accessed previous decades worth of climate data from government stations around the region, allowing us to produce very accurate models of the climatic conditions and the rainfall and water flows expected through the project area. Using that information, we've built in more than redundant capacity to deal with water inflows into the
tailings facility and into the project area, and we're also looking at state-of-the-art treatment for water discharge from the site. By doing that, we avoid what was one of the major causes of the problems they had in British Columbia, where the dam was actually overfilled with water that it wasn't designed to retain. We are not proposing to do that.
Well, Charles Cobb, state dam safety engineer, who could answer that question. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Charlie Cobb with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources Dam Safety and Construction Unit. There are some pretty significant differences between the Donlin project and the Mount Polly project, other than the design of the dam itself. One of the main problems at Mount Polly was the failure of the engineers to understand the foundation conditions in that dam. There was a unconsolidated deposit of glacial lacustrine silts and sands in the foundation, which actually led to the failure of that dam. There was also some construction issues where the dam had not been completed per the design. So the issue is not so much the difference between the dams as it is the failure of the engineers to understand the site conditions at the Mount Polly project. So given Donlin's commitment to the research necessary to understand the project setting out there, we're pretty confident that we will not see a repeat of anything similar to that.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not so much a follow-up, and I happen to have known the answer to that question when I asked it, but it was to point out that you'll see sometimes some campaigns opposing it, and they'll use that dam as an example of, oh, don't mine. And so I wanted to put on the record and be very clear that this is a very different situation, a very different design, and that anyone out there is listening today, if they ever see that ad and see the destruction caused, understand that we are talking apples and oranges here. So my point was just to point out the safety that you guys have gone through to do that. So I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Heron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. James, it's good to see you again. James and I have known each other for many years. And so James and all the other disclaimer is the dam is in my election district. James, the excess capacity of the generation site plant that will be powered by gas, what are some of the possibilities for that excess capacity in the region?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heron, we wouldn't so much at this time have excess generating capacity as such with our plant, but what we would have is a lot of excess capacity within the pipeline. That would be a open access pipeline, and as such, it would be available to any third party, whether it's private or government, to tap into that pipeline for gas to power generation, should it be required.
Thank you. And one final question is, Representative Johnson has started the conversation, but it's going to be asked anyway. Donlin has been flying under the radar compared to another large mine. What's the difference between the other large mine and our large mine on the Kuskokwim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heron, you know, not being an expert on the other project, I would hesitate to comment on differences. I do think one of the big factors that has led to our sort of call it success or level of advancement in permitting, if you will, has been the long history of cooperation and engagement we have with our partners, not just at Calista and TKC, who are obviously core partners to the project, but our active engagement with the individual communities and the individual people out there. You probably know this better than I do, but I don't think you could go to any village in the Calista region or up on the Yukon and talk to anyone you meet there who hasn't either worked at Donlin or has a family member or knows somebody who's worked at Donlin. I think that long partnered history on the 20-year development of this project is the reason we've been able to move forward like we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you know, with permission, I've actually got three questions to link here. First, I'd like to say I really do wish you the best of luck with this project. It's a it's truly one of those that's really important to the future of the region and really important to the future of the state. So certainly we really, really want to wish you the best of success here. My first question is, you know, on your pipeline project, do you have a committed source of gas for that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, thank you for your comments. At this point, we do not know. The project is now advancing through permitting. The partners have committed to take the project through permitting, but have not yet made a commitment to construction of the project. As is common in large projects like this, where they are waiting to see how the permitting ends up before they make final decisions on commitment, and that would most likely be the point at which we would start to look for hard commitments on gas.
And thank you. And again, we also know very well that the actual mining activities are heavily regulated. They involve a great deal of both state and federal permitting process. Does your proposed natural gas pipeline itself, does it entail any public regulatory agency or public regulatory oversight or permitting separate from your activities involved in actually permitting the resource development?
The pipeline itself, the mine, and all the associated infrastructure are covered under a single permitting process. There's a single EIS. There will be a single wetlands permit for the entire project. Obviously, the various components of the project would have various individual permits. From a regulatory perspective, this would be an open access line. It'd be a contract carrier, and as such, would be regulated by the state. Not sure if I answered that question correctly, Peter.
You've really anticipated my third question, which was the chart that you showed us of your EIS process. Mm-hmm. That is one EIS for the entire process in project, including resource development and the gas pipeline development.
That is correct, yes.
And then your clarity that you believe that the regulatory authority over this particular pipeline would be state regulatory authority.
That is correct.
Through the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hawker just took two of my questions, so I got those things covered. But I did want to comment, because Representative Herron brought it up, because I think it's an important point of distinction about the different tailings ponds. And with the other big mine, their tailings pond is designed to be like Mount Polly, the one that failed. And so it was good this over the summer to have a presentation about the three different tailing ponds options and what Representative Johnson, I think we're at the same presentation, alluded to, just to build a higher level of confidence in the safety surrounding this project. So I just want to comment on that. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
okay. Representative Seaton. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering, we had a mine, Illinois Creek, that the state had to take over, bankruptcy and pollution problems. And there was significant bonding, or it was not enough bonding was required at the time, and we found that out. But there was enough gold left that was recovered to pay the costs of that. How does this work with this not being on state land? Are there still bonding requirements for those kind of events, you know, possibilities? I'm not saying that that would happen, but I mean, sure. You know, looking downstream.
Mr. Chair, Representative Seaton, that's a great question. Basically, the bonding requirements, the state bonding requirements on private land are the same as they are on state land. As such, before we could start construction, we have to have approval of both our reclamation and closure plan and the bond or bonds associated with that closure plan. In the case of Donlin, we're looking at a bonding instrument both for the immediate sort of physical closure activities, which would be substantial, of the order of hundreds of millions of dollars, and then a further instrument for covering any long-term costs associated with the closure, such as water treatment and so on. So it will be fully bonded. The state process requires that closure plan and the associated bond be updated on a five-year basis as the project moves through operations and construction.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could you let us know, Barrick and Nova have worked on what other projects in Alaska? And then similarly, if I could get a sense of what work they've been, big projects in Canada.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Josephson, Nova Gold is what we call a sort of a junior mining company. They do not own and operate any other projects, although they are involved in the development of another project in British Columbia called Galore Creek, which is currently in the pre-feasibility study of engineering, I believe. Barrick, on the other hand, is the world's largest gold mining corporation at this time. They've recently slimmed the company down. I think a few years ago we owned something like 27 mines around the world. Now I believe we're down to maybe about 20 or so. We own and operate many of the large mines in Nevada. Most of our core assets are located in Nevada. And I believe, operate one or possibly two mines in Canada. I'm not entirely clear on that.
If I could follow up.
Go ahead.
The mines in the Seward Peninsula area near Nome,
mm-hmm.
One of them, was it Nova Copper or Nova Gold? And is there some connection between the two?
Correct. That was Nova Gold. Sorry, I should have addressed that. That was a operation that I believe was closed down and where it was permitted, operated for a brief while, and then closed down a few years back. That was Nova Gold. And I believe they have now sold that property or closed it. I'm not sure if the state has released a bond at this point. That would be a question for someone else.
Okay. Thanks.
Anybody else? Thank you very much for your presentation. Do you have anything to add?
No. Thank you very much, Mr.
Okay. Thank you very much for your presentation. And before I close, there's some donuts over there. The Health Food Resources Company has donuts. Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson. for your phone, mishap. So we have that. You can take some home or give them to your little kids, whatever. So, before we adjourn, is there any other business before the committee? If not, meeting is adjourned at 2:33.